You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, quarantine fatigue. People are feeling it, we're feeling it, and we're going to talk about beating it safely and smartly. First, the pandemic has presented some big challenges for businesses of all sizes, but small businesses in particular are trying to deal with the hurdles, and they don't have as many resources. The Small Business Development Center Network was designed to help with that, does free consulting for businesses with fewer than 500 employees. And during the new coronavirus outbreak, the center in northwestern Wisconsin has been taking a lot of calls from business owners trying to navigate the outbreak. Tara Carr is the director of the Small Business Development Center at UW Green Bay. Tara, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
How is the Small Business Development Center trying to fulfill its mission right now as businesses are dealing with a pandemic?
Yeah, right now it's just been an overwhelming cry out from local businesses, and we are in the disaster mitigation, recovery, and restart mode.
Okay, tell us more about that.
Well, from the our center here in Northeast Wisconsin at UW Green Bay, we actually were privileged enough to receive additional staff members from the University Leadership Administration, and we changed our typical service model, and we've been able to provide frontline triage to all businesses and not just our clients. And so since January 1, we have actually been able to counsel 414 clients in an additional 713 businesses. So that's a total of 1,127 businesses that we've been consulting here. And typically our center consults 350 a year. So you can imagine the workload and the need right now for consulting advice trying to get through this crisis.
How are you managing to actually connect with all of those people?
Well, we had a very interesting strategy here internally. Our goal was to serve the most amount of small businesses as possible within our region. So our center covers 12 counties, so from Sheboygan up to Door and around the Bay all the way up to Florence and Florence counties. And we really wanted to remove any hurdles that could impede information to business owners as we went through this triage of consulting and try to get them the information that they needed to apply for the injury, the economic injury disaster loan and the Paycheck Protection Program, and to get their finances in order.
Yeah, you have a front row seat to how helpful or difficult the different government relief programs have been. How is it looking from where you stand?
Well, you know, it's been a slow process. We've actually, our department has been working from home since the 12th of March. So, you know, as the relief packages have come out, it's been a learning curve. There's been a lot of guidance and direction from the SBA as administrators through the federal programs. It's taken a little bit of a time from the federal government to get that information to the SBA. But the SBA did a really great job training us with multiple webinars every day for several weeks in a row so that we could get that information out to our clients and service those clients. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just wondering what small business owners are looking for, what they need more or less from our governments.
Well, you know, right now they really need overhead and to have the overhead covered so that they can stay in business. It has been a challenge for certain businesses, and depending on the type and the size, that the Paycheck Protection Program was designed specifically for payroll and to keep people employed, and that has worked for some. However, that has not worked for all, and it has been more beneficial for some businesses to cut as many expenses as possible to stay alive and to stay financially stable until they can get through this crisis.
Tara Carr is the director of the Small Business Development Center at UW-Green Bay, and we're talking about her work with small businesses as they figure out how to handle being closed or really restricted during our Safer at Home measure, and as people begin shopping and doing things again as our restrictions are lifted. Tara, what about when you take the call from small business owners and you talk to them? What kind of tone are you hearing? Are they optimistic or frustrated or scared?
Well, it really has changed a lot over the past 2 months. We've seen a lot of the seven stages of grief. And I think at first there was a lot of frustration and anger and confusion. And honestly, they were very scared. And, it hasn't been a good experience for them, and it's been very challenging emotionally. And our goal is to provide that support and provide that empathy, and then come in and be able to provide the professional expertise in terms of that specific business, because having a blanketed approach to everyone doesn't always work. And it's really important for us to understand what that specific business need is and how we can advise them the best.
And you said that you've heard the different emotions change as you've been consulting over these last 2 months. So what does it look like now?
Well, the SBA is still processing the economic injury disaster loan applications from earlier later last month. They are still making those awards. As that money is coming in, businesses are reaching out and asking what the best step, what they should be doing. As they're getting the paycheck protection checks, how to spend that and to make sure that they're making decisions that are best for their situation as well.
Mm-hmm. And certainly, you mentioned that you can't take a blanket approach to all of this, but how are you talking to business owners? What are some of the ways you're telling them to think about this pandemic as they try to figure out how this affects them now, 6 months from now, a year from now? What kind of mindset do we need?
Well, yeah, for sure. Initially, we wanted to make sure that we reached out to them to make sure that they were receiving the help that they needed from an expert. We were advising them to get their finances in order, do a 13-week rolling forecast to get their finances so they understood how to get through the next several months, to defer payments, to go interest only. And really now it's transitioning to pivoting their business model. And when we start thinking about what is next, business is changing, and they need to be prepared to meet the needs of the customers and the demand of those customers, especially right now as we're going through this transition with businesses starting to open. Customers need to feel safe, right? They need to feel comfortable, and the businesses need to meet those customer expectations.
So where are you seeing some of the success stories with businesses you work with? Where are you finding some hope in this?
Yeah, it's hard, right, with all the gloom and doom and the financial hardship. It is difficult to see that silver lining, but we are seeing businesses pivot. We hear all these stories about distilleries now making sanitizer and Panera now offering groceries and businesses delivering and going curbside that they've never done before. And these small little changes, we're even seeing craft brewers, they're having to-go sales, and more importantly, they're teaming up with their competitors and trying to change that supply chain and work together to meet the needs of all those small businesses, to be able to sell their product.
So not just competition, but you're seeing real collaboration.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think moving forward, too, when we look at consumerism and how that's going to change, foot traffic, for most businesses, that's what they rely on. And that's going to continue to change, especially if this pandemic comes back, and when we start thinking about, in the future, in the next 6 to 9 months, more businesses are going online. Their consumer needs are at home. So they're not spending money the same way. There's also a loss of income. So consumer spending has changed because of the layoffs and the job loss and the furloughs. So their needs are, the businesses are really adjusting to that consumer need.
Tara, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
That was Tara Carr with the Small Business Development Center at UW Green Bay with us to talk about the center's free consulting for small businesses and the work that they've been doing during this coronavirus outbreak. You can find more information about the Small Business Development Center network, including all 13 locations that are across the state. Just visit our website, wpr.org/centraltime. Coming up, certain places hold strong memories for us, and we can't necessarily go to them right now. We're talking about how places are part of our identity and hearing about some of your most treasured places, too, here on Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina, and this is the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. Coming up, we talk about weighing the risks of leaving your home and fighting quarantine fatigue. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network for that conversation. Now, pause for a moment. Think back. Where have you spent the most time in your life? Your hometown, a childhood house, a school campus, a park? We can develop attachments to the places we go and the places where memories are made, which is why you might be wishing you could visit somewhere right now or maybe smile when you think of a past vacation. So we're wondering what those happy places are from you. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Are there places you feel like are part of your identity that you've got strong memories or attachments to? 800-642-1234 is the number to call now, or you can comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Susan Clayton is Whitmore Williams Professor of Psychology and Chair of Environmental Studies at the College of Worcester in Ohio. Susan, thanks for joining us to talk about this.
Oh, hi, Keeley. Thanks for inviting me.
Certainly. Is this something we kind of just imagine in our heads, or is there really something to this feeling that we have toward a place that we just like to go?
Absolutely. I think most of us form strong connections to some, at least one place in our lives. And there's some research that suggests, in fact, those feelings of attachment to place can actually make you more resilient.
Why might that be, that feeling like you belong or that some place is part of who you are can make you more resilient?
Well, I think you really hit the nail on the head by talking about the connection to identity. We really, you know, we're very visual people. So when we think about who we are, we think about our memories. Those memories are located in particular places. And so having that sort of sense of continuity with those places creates a kind of a security for us. It's an external reminder of who we are and just a sense that, well, that place that I had those experiences persist.
Certainly, it could be to many different places that we make connections. But I think one that seems most obvious is hometowns, where we grew up, even if it was good or bad. There's just something about the role that that place plays in our identities. Why is that?
Well, it's partly just the longevity. Of course, the more time you spend in a place, the more time you have to develop those memories. And in a hometown, hopefully for most of us, there were positive experiences and significant emotional connections to people. So our connection to place can still be affected by the interactions with other people we had in those places.
No, you're just fine. But I just heard you say that. And I thought, so the place is one thing. And it's also all of the connections that we've made there and the experiences that we've had there. So it's physical, but it's also the time we've spent.
It's also time and it's also social. The two things are not separate. Our social interactions take place in physical places.
So what about things like restaurants, bars, salons, or shopping spots? I mean, can we develop attachments to places like those that don't have the obvious nostalgia of the hometown?
Yeah, absolutely. I was actually just talking to my son last night about a bar I remembered from graduate school where I would go regularly with my friends and feeling that nostalgia towards that particular bar, which had, you know, cheap beer and free food at happy hour. So it was perfect for graduate students.
So we kind of weave them together and they become part of our story.
Exactly. So that bar was significant to me because that was such a specific time in my life. You know, the years I spent in graduate school, that specific circle of friends. And so the bar kind of, it almost sums up some of the things I did during that time in graduate school.
We're talking with Susan Clayton, who is Whitmore Williams Professor of Psychology and Chair of Environmental Studies at the College of Worcester in Ohio. And we're talking about how we can become attached and connected to places, not just people or things, but to places. And we're going all over the place while talking about this, but we're stuck at home right now, a lot of us are. And that means that we've got big events that we're having to celebrate right here. We're talking about, you know, birthdays or a couple of holidays will be in this, you know, self-quarantine. Is there something particularly special about the places we go for those significant events?
I think it varies, but for a lot of people, there are definitely places they like to return to, especially to link to a specific event, could it, you know, an anniversary or a birthday or a holiday of some sort. So I know that there are many people who are feeling sad that they can't do their traditional activities to commemorate those events. I've been, you know, reading posts on social media about people who say always go to a particular restaurant for an anniversary and aren't able to do it this year.
Sure. Well, and then we look at the summer, and even as our social distancing continues, even if we aren't restricted from doing that, we're looking at things like state fairs, 4th of July, festivals, concerts that are not happening anymore. There are lots of memories there. Is there something like really particular about those once a year places that you do return to? Like, why does that matter differently than, say, you know, the park that we like to frequent?
Well, I think a lot of us have this sort of internalized calendar, and it's kind of it makes life more interesting rather than just every day being another day, one after the other. We mark the year to ourselves, and that's why we have, you know, holidays and anniversaries. And to link those things to particular places helps to mark those, you know, distinctive events in the calendar year.
Oh, sure. Right. I love that idea that it just kind of, it helps us keep time moving. It helps ground us in those moments. We have Joe from Jefferson who'd like to join our conversation. Hi, Joe.
Hi, guys. Great topic. I seems like over 50, I've noticed the past couple years, every so often throughout the day, sometimes several times, I'll just suddenly envision like a mental picture of a place, either where I grew up or it's got to be from a while back. And I'm just thinking about this spot, like if I just want to go there, even if it's the intersection, where usually there's something a little more to it, like a park, and it just pops up in my head. And I'm just wondering, since you have a psychologist here, maybe she could analyze that for me.
Joe, thanks for that. Joe's reaching back and remembering these places. Susan, what do you think? Pretty common?
Yes, absolutely. And I can say that it happens more. It seems to happen more often to me as well as I get older. I think what is probably the case, according to people who specialize this, is that we have seen something or maybe heard something that reminded us of that particular place in a way that we weren't necessarily conscious of. So maybe it was even, you know, the shape of a particular bush or the smell of suntan lotion. And suddenly this memory of being in a particular place sort of seems like it pops into our head without prompting, but there probably was some kind of prompt there.
And Joe also mentioned he feels like sometimes he just wants to go there. There's that yearning of, wow, I'd like to be back in that place. Why might we have that feeling that, gosh, if I could right now, I'd be right there?
Well, I think right now, a lot of us just want to be any place else than stuck in our home. So there's that.
Right.
Hopefully when we have these memories, they're probably memories of positive experiences, and there's a sense that the experience and the emotion associated with that experience is somehow linked to the place. So we think if we went back to that place, We would recapture that emotion. And, you know, I think that doesn't always happen. And there's lots of I think, literature surrounding that idea that sometimes when we go back to a place, we do not recapture the emotion that we expected to get there.
Yeah, we've been talking a lot about places, you know, bars, homes. What about those green spaces, state parks, trail systems, backyards? What in particular about the outside environment should we think about when it comes to these feelings of being attached?
Oh, gosh, there's so much to be said about that. One thing is when you ask people as adults what special places they remember, these sort of outdoor places are disproportionately represented. So I think, you know, for many people, that time spent in outdoor settings really had that emotional resonance. And one of the reasons I think those places are so important to us is that it's just calming and relaxing to be out in nature. But also a lot of people report that they go out into these natural settings for self-reflection. So surprisingly, being outdoors actually is an opportunity for us to get more in touch with ourselves and our own sort of goals and values.
And when you go to one of those places, maybe it's not something you're digging up from the past. Maybe it is one of the places that makes you feel good now and you feel attached to it. What should we do there? What should we think about while we're there when we recognize that this place is special for me?
Well, I think one thing that nature does really well is encourages us to pay attention and in important ways, because, you know, right now I'm in a room, I'm talking to you via my computer. So I'm kind of tuning out my environment and I'm only using the one sense of what I can hear. And in a lot of our daily lives, even before the pandemic, that's true. We tend to not use all of our senses. But when we're out in a natural environment, it tends to encourage us to use more sensory channels, if you will. So we don't only look at it, we smell it, we feel the breeze, we can hear, you know, the bird song or whatever. So I think nature just kind of grabs our attention and kind of forces us to pay attention to things that sometimes we just ignore.
Susan, thank you for speaking with us today. Susan Clayton is Whitmore Williams Professor of Psychology and Chair of Environmental Studies at the College of Worcester in Ohio. We've been talking about place attachment, why we have feelings toward a place, and how places are part of our identities. Coming up, staying so home so much might make you a little restless. We're talking about how to live during the pandemic and be smart about the risks. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, hospital systems are set to lose an estimated $200 billion in this pandemic. Leaders of Wisconsin's hospitals reveal how the financial hit will affect their facilities and how they're handling the loss of revenue. That's on The Morning Show, which airs from 6 to 9 a.m. here on the Ideas Network. Now, most of us are spending a lot of time at home, and it's taking its toll. People are tired of needing to stay put, away from friends and colleagues, even unfamiliar human contact in restaurants, bars, sporting events. We are social creatures, so social distancing and quarantining provokes a negative response. And for those of us feeling a fatigue around quarantine, and I mean those of us feeling it, what do we do? How do we keep living with this pandemic and being socially responsible? And how can we relate to others who are doing the same thing? Dr. Patrick Remington is Professor Emeritus at the UW-Madison Department of Population Health Sciences and Director of UW's Preventative Medicine Residency Program. And he's here to talk about it with us. Dr. Remington, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
I really thought at the beginning of this, you know, I'm committed, I get it, I totally understand, and I can do this, and I'm still all of those things, but the I can do this is wavering a little bit, even for me, and when I was so confident. So where is this restlessness coming from, and am I alone here?
No, I don't think you're alone. I think we see this in any approach where we say that, sort of just say no, or like an abstinence-only curriculum. it might sound good to say stay safe at home and use a mass quarantine, but after a while, people begin to want to take some risks, assessing their own risk, risk of developing disease and the consequences, but also assessing the risk they might pose to others. So it's just a natural reaction once time evolves that people want to explore their own risk and get back to work or get back to socializing.
So some of this does have to do with the length that we're seeing these stay-home restrictions and that feeling building.
Yeah, there's no question that the duration of this quarantine has been wearing on people. The other thing I think a natural reaction is people have gone out. We know from cell phone data that people are beginning to go out to parks, to go out maybe visit neighbors, again, keeping physically distant. So we see that people are venturing forth. And if you do that a few times and nothing bad happens, you begin thinking, well, maybe I can do it a bit more. It's sort of testing the water. And again, we still know that there's significant risk of disease transmission, and particularly in high-risk settings. But again, as people are taking baby steps, they're noticing that it seemed to work, and so they're willing to take more.
So do we just need to accept then that there's inherent risk there and hope that we'll be okay? Or are there ways that we can get out of this cooped-up feeling and still be responsible?
Well, I think it's a balance between understanding the benefits of staying at home and being quarantined. You reduce the risk to virtually zero because you have no contact. You don't leave the house and nobody comes into the house. But we know that can't last. The other end of the spectrum is to go out and to go to house parties or to go to jam-packed bars or sporting events. And we've seen time and time again when that happens, invariably there'll be disease transmission, an outbreak, and lots of people get sick and some people die. So it's that balance between staying home and going out back to business as usual that we're trying to figure out. And I think each individual has to recognize that there is a risk to going out and to getting an infection. But you need to assess, first of all, the science. What do we know about how this virus is transmitted? And second, what's your tolerance for risk, both for yourself but also the risk that you might pose to others? If you were to get sick, are you a healthcare provider? Are you visiting people who might be at home? And if that's the case, then you may be less likely to take risk, not just for yourself, but the risk you pose to others.
Mm. Dr. Patrick Remington is director of UW's Preventive Medicine Residency Program, and you're part of our conversation right now about feeling some quarantine fatigue. How is the stay-home order affecting you? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. We want to know, how are you managing this? Are you having difficulty continuing to keep socially distant? Has it gotten easier for you since the Safer at Home order went into effect? Or maybe it feels harder. Share your story with us at 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Dr. Remington, you said we can't all stay home forever, and yet don't extreme measures like this, everybody staying home, ultimately work?
Oh, of course. If everyone stayed home, we would see maybe one or two cycles within each family, and then the virus would disappear. The virus can't jump out a window or come into your house. So it's an extremely effective method of stopping an epidemic. But we know that some people can't stay home. They're part of the essential workforce, healthcare providers, people providing food and our community safety, police and fire. So we can't be perfect in the stay-at-home order. But the other thing is that staying at home for people who need to go out to earn a living, that's incredibly hard. If you are in the service industry or if you're in the in business where you literally have to go out to earn a living, then that's a very untenable long-term solution. It worked for the last few months. We've seen a dramatic decline in transmission, and we haven't seen what we predicted, which was to be a huge epidemic exceeding our healthcare system's ability to treat really sick people. But now we're sort of lulled into the feeling that since we didn't see that, it's not so risky. And that is not the case. This virus is still circulating in communities. About 95% of the public is still immune and susceptible, sorry, not immune, susceptible to infection. And so if we just go back to business like it was back in January, February, we will see significant outbreaks in disease and death.
So we were asked to stay home. We've stayed home. We've avoided the worst possible scenario. And then we figure, well, I guess it wasn't that bad anyway. So we're safe.
Yes, but we're also in a much better place in the public health system. Mm-hmm. When we put the stay at home or the safer at home order into place, we did not have the testing capacity. We didn't have the public health workforce in place to respond. We're getting there with testing. You heard a news story at the top of the hour where there's lines of people looking to get tested with symptoms or in an occupation where they need to know if they're positive. And the other thing is the public health workforce, the traditional public health approach to a infectious disease like this is to identify cases by testing, isolate them, and then do intensive contact tracing, where we ask the people, where have you been during the period when you might have been contagious? And we call those other folks up or we visit them and we ask them to self-quarantine, to basically go home because they may be infected and they may become contagious. And that's how you sort of do the 101 public health approach. And we will soon have the people in place to do that. We're not quite there. We're in a big hiring program at the state health department, local health department, but we need that public health infrastructure as we begin to go back to business slowly.
So you might be feeling antsy, but don't be lulled into the idea that because we haven't seen the most catastrophe that we're safe.
No, the virus hasn't changed, and the illness will come. People will get sick. We will see continued transmission. What we want to do is reduce the risk. But if it does happen, and it will happen, then we want to have the ability to make a quick diagnosis, implement an isolation for that person who's sick, but then go out and find out everybody that person has been in contact with through contact tracing, and then ask those people to go home, stay safe at home, be quarantined, so that if they do get sick, they don't get others sick as a result.
We're talking with Dr. Patrick Remington. He's Professor Emeritus in UW-Madison's Department of Population Health Sciences about the breaking points that people are trying to navigate when it comes to this extended social distancing. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How are you holding up while you're holed up? What about after Governor Evers extended the order? Did your mindset change? Or are you doing okay? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Our conversation continues here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina, and we're talking with public health expert Dr. Patrick Remington about the realities of quarantine fatigue, how it feels, and what we have to weigh when we determine if we should leave the house. And we want to hear from you. 800-642-1234. Have you been out to a store since the new stay-home order allowing people to since the new order allowing people to shop into the stores went in effect yesterday? What was that experience like? Did it help break down some of your quarantine fatigue? Or have you decided to stick tight to home and wait it out? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. And Dr. Remington, what's a sustainable way that we can balance the public health need for us to stay away from one another and our need as social creatures to connect?
Well, a couple of things. First, I personally have found some of the online social media platforms like Zoom and WebEx to be incredibly engaging. So I've talked to many people who have connected with family members or friends that they haven't seen for many, many years through the online social engagement software. So I think that's one way. Just because you're physically distant doesn't mean you have to be socially distant. I think the other thing is that we know the biology of this virus pretty well. We know that it comes out of a sick person maybe before their symptoms develop, but it tends not to float in the air for hours at a time. It tends to go 4 or 5 or 6 feet and then drop. So if you can avoid spreading it by wearing a mask, even if you're not sick, I think it's a good a precautionary measure to put a mask on, because you could have been infected. You could be pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic, and just wearing a mask is a signal that you really are concerned about not getting others sick. And then keeping 6 feet away, the chance of getting infected if you keep that physical distance between you and others is very small. And those things, just good hand hygiene, physical distancing, and wearing a mask to prevent others from getting sick, should you be sick and not know it, those things can make a huge difference. And you can still interact. You can still gather with people, but keep a distance.
And yet there's social pressure there, in that we know that that's the public health guideline. But certainly I don't want other people to think that because I'm wearing a mask or because I'm standing 6 feet away that I am afraid of them or concerned that they will infect me, although in general we are concerned about transmission. I mean, you're saying those moves are really about protecting everybody else.
Yeah, it's a cultural change. Certainly in Asia, the use of masks has been longstanding and it's accepted. It doesn't raise eyebrows. But the last few months, it has raised eyebrows to see people wearing masks, to see people riding a bike bringing carry out to your car. So I think we'll get used to that. I think it'll become normative to see people wearing masks. Certainly if you go to a clinic or to a healthcare system, you'll see everybody wearing a mask. In fact, not only a mask, but a shield. You'll see plexiglass separation between customers and people working. So I think this will be slowly become more normative as we look not to the few weeks or months, but really a couple of years before the risk of transmission is down or a vaccine is developed.
All right. We're talking with Dr. Patrick Remington about handling that cooped up feeling that we feel as we've stayed home for around 2 months for a lot of people now. And we've got Betsy in Crystal Lake, Illinois, ready to join the conversation. Hey, Betsy.
Hi, Dr. Remington. I was very surprised that they would allow nail salons and hair salons open, because it's been my experience. I've had friends and myself.
And I'm not sure that we can hear Betsy anymore. But from what she said, Betsy said, you know, hair salons, nail salons, these are places where we're in close contact with one another, certainly violating that 6 foot guideline. Dr. Remington, what about those kinds of activities we might be tempted to do, like going to get a haircut, when we know that that puts ourselves and other people at risk? How do we balance that?
Well, this is exactly the question that we're struggling with. How do you balance the need for economic sustainability for people who, for example, people working in hair salons or in barbershops? That's what they need to do to make a living. Can you make that safe so that the risk is very small? We're doing that in healthcare systems through the use of masks and shields and use of gloves and gowning. So I think those are the type of precautionary measures that can be taken in a place like a hair salon, where people working there certainly don't want to be infected, so they should use these precautions, but also customers. The use of a mask, the use of careful hand washing, separating people rather than waiting and sitting in a chair right next to somebody, sitting remotely, or even waiting outside. So I think if you take certain precautions and you, most importantly, don't go into this setting if you're symptomatic at all. Don't go and wear a mask. If you have symptoms, stay away. Call your doctor, decide whether you need a test, and avoid those settings. But even if you're not symptomatic, take the precautions. And I would do as much as you could. If that's an essential service and you feel you want to go get a haircut or go to a hair salon, then take as many precautions as you can.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Remington. We really appreciate you catching us up on this and talking about that quarantine fatigue that's weighing on some of us. We appreciate your time.
Okay. Thank you.
That's Dr. Patrick Remington, Professor Emeritus in the UW-Madison Department of Population Health Sciences and also Director of UW's Preventive Medicine Residency Program. And we talked to him today about getting through the difficulties of being ordered to largely stay at home for weeks, maybe months on end. As the state continues to see the number of new coronavirus cases grow, Milwaukee's communities of color have been hit particularly hard. In March, Governor Tony Evers called African-American deaths in the city related to COVID-19 a crisis within a crisis. Since then, nearly half of the cases and deaths in Milwaukee have been minorities. Corrine Hess has more.
It started as a fever in mid-March, and then Lawrence Riley had trouble catching his breath. His daughter, Whitley, says Riley's fever broke, then he got worse.
My mama had to get him dressed. He just wasn't his normal self.
On March 16th, the 66-year-old Navy veteran and former Milwaukee firefighter was taken to the hospital. 3 days later, Riley was the first person in Milwaukee County to die from complications of coronavirus. Whitley says her dad had chronic inflammatory lung disease, known as COPD. But before he tested positive for the virus, her family didn't realize COVID-19 had reached Milwaukee.
We knew that the virus had hit America, but we didn't think that, you know, it had hit Wisconsin or Milwaukee. So when they took him in and, like, tested him right away, that was just a shock.
As of May 11th, there have been more than 4,000 cases of coronavirus in Milwaukee County and 219 deaths. African Americans represent about a quarter of the county's population, but account for almost half of the deaths. Of the 219 coronavirus-related deaths, 108 of the victims were Black, including Riley. Racial disparities in health outcomes, including childhood lead poisoning, infant mortality, and obesity, have plagued Milwaukee for years. So much so that in 2019, Milwaukee County declared racism to be a public health crisis. Dr. Ben Weston heads emergency medicine for Milwaukee County. He says the COVID-19 outbreak makes the disparities more obvious.
We can see that an African-American person is nearly three times more likely to die of COVID-19 in Milwaukee County than a white person. And they're a staggering seven times more likely to die of COVID than a white person in the state of Wisconsin.
Milwaukee was one of the first cities in the country to break down coronavirus data by race. As more cities have done so, national data shows counties with more African-American residents have more coronavirus cases. Melanie McCurtis is a community organizer in Metcalf Park. The neighborhood is 98% African-American and 76% of the residents there are renters. The neighborhood is also one of the city's coronavirus hotspots. Despite the risk, McCurtis says when you're poor, coronavirus isn't a priority.
Top worry is food, and then it's COVID-19, it's rent, it's a medley of things. I mean, our families are concerned about all of these things at one time.
The food pantry in Metcalf Park is only open 3 hours a week, so food is scarce and social distancing is impossible. McCurtis has been delivering care packages every other week. She says people are inside their homes, but the community is still at risk.
I'm at risk from COVID-19 because I'm poor. I'm at risk of getting this virus and because I still have to go and work this job, or I still have to go and get food, and I still might have to travel on the bus.
Recently, Milwaukee's Hispanic community has also seen a greater increase in COVID-19 cases. Weston says COVID-19 is spreading quickly in communities of color because of decades-long disparities. Whether this will lead to meaningful change by ways of safer homes, fresher food, and easier access to health care after the pandemic remains to be seen. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And as the impact of COVID-19 grows here in our state of Wisconsin, our WPR reporters are stationed around the state to bring us the latest news and developments. You can find a slew of information at WPR.org/COVID. You can also find conversations from here on the Ideas Network. So if you've missed one or you're looking to listen again, you can go on to WPR.org/COVID. And you can actually submit your own question. We have a group of journalists who are working to answer it. And that is another option. And we've got great in-depth resources for you available at wiscontext.org. So that's another great resource that you can find to catch up on what's happening in Wisconsin when it comes to the COVID-19 outbreak. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, more people are turning to food assistance in this new coronavirus outbreak. Wisconsin's food banks are finding creative ways to get people what they need. That's just one of the conversations that we'll be having tomorrow on Central Time about how those food banks are finding those creative solutions to the problem.